Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase, every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Hacks is back for season 3, and so is the official Hacks podcast. In each episode, Hacks creators Lucia Aniello, Paul W. Downs, and Jen Statsky speak with cast and crew members to unpack the Emmy-winning comedy series.
You'll hear Hannah Einbinder and Jean Smart speak to their on-screen dynamic, along with stories from the show's writer's room, on-set antics, and creating the world that Deborah and Ava inhabit. Watch Hacks, streaming exclusively on Max, and listen to the official Hacks podcast on Max or wherever you get your podcasts.
Look out. It's only films to be buried with.
Hello and welcome to Films to be Buried With. My name is Brett Goldstein. I'm a comedian, an actor, a writer, a director, a ball boy, and I love films. As Isaac Asimov once said, "Never let your sense of morals prevent you from doing what is right." Sure, we all find Citizen Kane a tiny bit boring, but that doesn't mean it's not excellent. Fighting talk from Asimov there. Every week, I invite a special guest over. I tell them they've died, then I get them to discuss their life through the films that meant the most to them. Previous guests include Sharon Stone, Jameela Jamil, Kevin Smith, and even Med Pambles. But this week is the incredible comedian, actor, writer, musician, and all-round genius, Mr. Julian Barrett. Head over to the Patreon at patreon.com/Brett Goldstein, where you'll get an amazing extra 20 minutes or more with Julian, where he tells a very difficult secret. We discuss the greatest opening and closing to films and all sorts of other stuff. Plus, you also get the whole episode uncut and ad-free as a video. Check it out over at patreon.com/Brett Goldstein. And if you've not yet seen it, I know I say it every week, but just in case, do you know what I mean? Why not? You can watch the whole of season 1 of Ted Lasso on the Apple TV Plus app. Watch it, you'll laugh, you'll cry, you'll love it. I mean it. Anyway, so, Julian Barrett. I mean, this was a big one, wasn't it? You know him from everything, from The Mighty Boosh to Nathan Barley to Ag to Flowers to Mindhorn to everything. He is always amazing. I'm a massive fan of his. I was so excited to get to talk to him. I'd never met him before. We did this over Zoom, and over the course of the episode, the light in the room he was in got darker and darker and darker, and for a long time we didn't mention it. I'd say it's worth joining the Patreon just to see the video. It looks like a film noir. It's amazing. The other thing is, there was an issue with the sound in the recording. I don't know why, some glitch or something. And my producer buddy Peace has been an absolute hero in rescuing this episode. I think there's a couple of things, like it might sound weird, different levels occasionally, stuff like that, because he had to cut back and forth. I don't understand it. Anyway, he's done an amazing job. Hopefully you won't notice. But if occasionally you think, this sounds a bit weird, that's why. So, you know, it's all there. Don't worry about it. I think you're going to love it. So that is it for now. I very much hope you enjoy episode 131 of Films to be Buried With. Hello and welcome to Films to be Buried With. It is me, Brett Goldstein, and I am joined today by an actor, a writer, a producer, a musician, a jazz man, a sketch man, a stand-up man, a hero, a legend. I can't believe we've got him on the pod. Please welcome to the show, the brilliant Mr. Julian Barrett.
Oh, thank you for having me. And thanks for all those lovely things.
So thank you for doing the show. We're recording over Zoom. You are in a child's bedroom, if I may.
I'm in a child's bedroom.
And you saw my office and asked if I was also in a child's bedroom.
But yes.
But I was in my office.
That's your life and your... Well, there's a Muppets poster behind you and a very tiny door that I can only imagine leads to a magical land.
Yes, you're quite right.
Where you get all your ideas from.
It's so good to have you on. I'm a massive fan.
Thank you.
Mindhorn.
Well, likewise. I love your stuff.
You love Mindhorn?
I love my stuff. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, it's really good.
I really love my own stuff. So glad that you like it too, because I love it. I don't, actually. I've got sort of body dysmorphia when it comes to my own stuff, a little bit.
How does it work with your... Because I was thinking that. I've got a few things I wanted to ask you. One is, like, your persona, not always the case in performances you do, but there's a sort of kind of self-hating kind of thing. And yet you are a creator. You make your own stuff. How do you edit stuff if you hate yourself?
How do you silence the inner critic?
Yeah.
I have to sort of wrong foot it, sort of. I have to jump quickly out the window and then come back in through the front door and make sure it doesn't see me. You know, so I have to be sort of stealthily avoid my... I had a bit of distance sometimes between what I've done and then when I'm editing, or if I'm writing, and then some distance or time or, you know, between the creative act and the editing act. Mm-hmm. So I just know. I mean, I do sort of find, even if I'm writing, you know, I hate, usually don't like it on the day or after written it, and then a few days later it somehow seems okay. You know, I don't know quite how that works.
That's interesting. It's just sort of,
I have to sort of back away from things and look at them from a different angle. Or if when I used to drink, I would have a drink of... I would do some writing and then go somewhere else, print it out and have a drink and then read it. And it felt like it was written by someone else. And then I go, oh, that's okay, that now. So little tricks to fool the inner critic, I suppose. I mean, acting-wise, it's sort of hard to watch initially, because you can't see anything but your own stupid face initially. And then you kind of... can watch it again and see the sort of more objective merit of things, I suppose. So, you know, I mean, I'm better than I was. I used to be quite down on things, but my own work, and but I'm not really. I mean, I think I'm more objective now about things.
But yeah,
yeah. I know. I tend to play. I can play. I do play a lot of characters who do have a sort of that kind of relationship with themselves.
Yeah. Do you watch older stuff if you catch, I don't know, an old episode that you're in from years ago, and do you go, oh, that's really good?
Yes, that's you didn't. Yeah, you see the joyous abandon of youth, and so that can be quite fun to see all that. And, but, you know, you don't watch your own stuff, really, do you? It's not for you somehow, so it's hard to, you know, I mean, I suppose some folks are more obsessed with watching their own stuff. I mean, it was very nice reaching an age... where my kids reaching an age when I could show them the Mighty Boosh, which is they then sort of discovered it because a mate of theirs had said they were watching it. So I thought, okay, well, maybe I'll... They knew about it, but I hadn't impressed it upon them, you know, as a sort of curriculum. You know, they sort of said, oh, a mate of theirs said they really like it. So I said, well, let's watch it then. So then that was the first time I'd watched it for a long time. And that was a very nice moment because it sort of worked for them and worked for me through the lens of distance. And so, yeah, that was quite good. So that was sort of I thought that was more of a valid reason for rewatching older work, sort of thing. Because it has a sort of nostalgic element, which you sometimes you feel a little bit like it's watching a party that you went to years ago, and you're going, you feel a slight sort of the sad sometimes, the nostalgia, you know. Anyway, but it's nice if you've got kids enjoying it at the present moment. Hey, so there's a little moment for you there.
That's lovely.
One of the things, sorry, just a little thing was, because I remember when they were very young, they watched The Mighty Boosh, and there was a guy in a gorilla suit, obviously, but it's reasonably lifelike. But they were, at the time, my children were 5, possibly 6 years old, I'm trying to think. So anyway, they totally believed that it was a real gorilla. You know, they're asking me about it and where I met the gorilla. And they were saying, oh, you know, he'd lived in England for a long time, so he'd learned to speak and things. And then their birthday came along, and I got Dave Brown, who played Bolo the Ape, and got him to get into the outfit and come to their birthday party on the heath. So he got dressed up. It's a really tight, claustrophobic, rubber-moulded suit. Underneath this sort of giant framework. So it looks incredibly lifelike. And he came to the party. He went behind a sort of some trees on Hampstead Heath and came to their party. And obviously some of their children were absolutely shitting themselves because there was a giant gorilla. But he had a little hat on and some other stuff. So that took the edge off it a bit. But they knew, they were like, they couldn't believe that Bolo had come to their birthday party, you know. So it was pretty cred up for me. But then he was getting so hot, he came over to me and said, I'm actually melting here. I need to get out of here. So I said, okay. And then he went off running and waving goodbyes and ran off into the distance, straight over the over a hill and through a picnic that was happening on the other side of the hill. And right. I mean, they were screaming because from a distance, it looks like a gorilla. And we're not far from Regent's Park Zoo. So they probably for an instant thought, holy fuck. Sorry. Yeah, they would have been, that was a priceless moment. Anyway, that was just a little, little thing. That was one of the things you can do, I suppose, when you've got young kids and a show that involves gorillas.
That's really, really great. But tell me, in Mindhorn, which is
yes.
your film that you wrote as well?
With Simon Farnaby. Simon and I wrote that, yep.
And it's hilarious.
Oh,
and I loved
you.
It. And I saw it at the cinema and I was excited to see a proper film. But you're joyful in that.
Yes.
Mindhorn's, he's a joyful guy.
Yeah, yeah. That's good. It's a good character to play. I mean, I like his energy, definitely, yeah. That's a good thing, you know. You plug into these people, don't you? And if they're you feel the sort of their energy, you know. If that's not too pretentious, but you sort of you can really get yourself out of a bad mood or something. Certain characters, I find, and he's a broken man, but he's trying to find his way through. So there's a little bit of an arc for him there.
Yeah, and he's got a nice, quite useful sense of self-denial.
Oh, yes.
Lack of self-awareness.
Yes, I mean, that's those characters are, I always think it's just, that's me if I took a couple of wrong steps. Not many.
Just two.
Yeah, two wrong steps. One thing I shouldn't have done, perhaps, or one thing I should have done that I didn't, and then that's it, and then you're there, you know. So it's only, you're only a couple of inches away from it.
So if you feel the energy of your character, were you heavily depressed making flowers?
No, actually, that's completely contradicted myself. So, I mean, to be honest, it's the kind of thing on camera. In Flowers, there's a lot of... I was coming on and doing these pieces, and he was a depressed sort of character. So within the scenes themselves, which are, as you know, I'm filming, it's very fragmented, isn't it? And you're only really in that mode for a bit. I'm not I'm not a method actor, so I don't sort of... And I was with Olivia Colman, who certainly isn't a method actor at all. I mean, she's just incredible, but she, as soon as the camera stops, she's cracking jokes and doing things that are ridiculous. And so even if she's doing a scene where she's crying, you know, I mean, it's frightening to work with her because, of course, she can cry out of any eye or how many tears you want. And she'll also, on scenes where I said, can we just run through this scene? And she ran through it, and she was crying as she ran through the scene with me, which could, I was like, you know, she just has this ability to do that. So I don't, you know, I have to use every trick in the book, you know, to get my, emotions across. But so essentially it wasn't what I'm saying is it wasn't in any way depressing, really. And strangely, it was quite good fun with everyone sort of together in this weird old house in the... Yeah, quaint corner of England, just going sort of slightly mad. But that was actually, no, so that it didn't work like that. But I don't know. Mindhorn was a different thing. We were filming on the Isle of Man, which was a strange place to go.
Yeah.
Quite Wicker Man.
Oh, Julian.
You haven't recorded anything?
No, it's not that. I've forgotten to tell you something.
Oh, hello.
Oh, fuck. It's quite bad. It's quite bad that I didn't tell you this in the beginning. I should have opened with it. But I...
You got my scan results?
Possibly. I'll just say it and then we can deal with the fallout, I guess.
Okay.
You've died. You're dead.
I'm dead?
Yeah.
Okay.
How did you die?
Well, it's interesting. I didn't realise I was dead. So is this like a ghost? This is like a ghost thing?
Yeah, you are currently a ghost.
So I'm dead, but I'm not sure. I'm like Swayze.
You've got some unfinished business, but the unfinished business is you have to do a podcast.
Okay.
You've got like Ghost. Podcast. Right,
yeah, but he has to do a podcast.
He's got a bit of admin left over in his diary that he...
Yes, I mean, how did I die? That's the thing. I mean, I suppose... Oh, yeah, I was playing a guitar solo that was so fast that I literally... My heart burst and I dropped dead. in the midst of one of the greatest guitar solos that I ever did. Wow. So that's how it happened on stage, you know.
Where?
at the Bullen Gate, the pub.
Bullen Gate?
No, but I would just, I don't know. I remember looking at a post the other day of a picture of, we were rehearsing for the Mighty Boosh tour, and there was just this big warehouse, and we were doing a sound check for the show, and it was just in a big sort of empty warehouse space, and I was just stood in the middle with the guitar, and I remember that day, I was playing guitar, and there's no one there, it was just me, and I had this sort of white SG, Gibson SG, and I just thought, that is one of the... That's a very happy moment for me when I'm in my own space playing my guitar, and it's quite... So I thought, actually, then it just came to me, then it's quite... You know, if you're going to die, you've got to die when you're doing something, I suppose, where you feel, I'm pretty happy at this point, so may as well die.
Died as he lived, playing an S. Gibson in an empty warehouse.
Yeah, yeah, that was all pre-kids, of course, now. It's a bit more difficult now. Dying when you're just on, it's just you dying, and the ramifications are sort of sad, but not sort of, you can sort of get more into that. So, but that sounds like a good way to go.
Do you worry about death? Do you think about death a lot?
Yes, on and off. Yeah. I sort of convince myself not to quite a lot of the time, and then it creeps back in sometimes, often at 3 a.m.
Yeah.
The hour of the wolf, apparently. So the hour when most people commit suicide or something, or most people die or something. So I do have a sort of, I can go there and I can get caught into those spirals, I suppose. Yeah, definitely. I mean, I remember reading a book or parts of a book called The Denial of Death, which was quite interesting, about how we're all basically just running screaming from it, but trying in different ways to pretend it's not going to happen. And comedy seems to be one of those things as well.
Yes, completely. Comedy is entirely a group of people running, screaming from death. And that's why they say you died on stage when you have a really bad gig, because you didn't escape death. You died.
Yes. I know. I remember dying all over the place, all over the map when I first started doing stand-up.
Mm-hmm.
Just going out at night. I didn't tell anyone I was doing it because I never wanted anyone to see what I was doing. I know some people, they sort of want their friends to come along and see them do gigs and things. I never did that. I used to go off on my own, like a murderer, except I was dying. You
know, shit murderer.
Yeah. So I would go off somewhere, get killed, and then come back, a sort of quarter of the man that left. And that was sort of what would happen. And I eventually learned to sort of, I suppose, die, because you always are going to die with dignity, perhaps. So you, when you start seeing it going wrong, you would just go, okay, this isn't going to work. Whereas initially, the worst deaths were when I didn't know what, I thought, oh, I can make this work, and would be trying. And every time I tried, it was never going to work. It was like going into a room, but going in under the carpet. And then, so I was just this brown lump sort of moving around, trying to go, there was no way I was going to get anything, but I tried and tried. And they were the worst deaths, the early deaths. And then I eventually learned that I could die slightly more.
How do you die with dignity?
You realize that it's a conversation that is between two. It's like, you're not going to make this work. So you, I suppose you can put the defenses up a bit and then realize that this isn't going to work. And thanks. But, you know, maybe this wasn't meant to be. Good luck. Because you know that mine was a lot more to do with the sort of weirdness of the personality and the strangeness of the material. And it wasn't so much like some jokes were good that I wrote, but mostly it was the sort of personality of the act and the strangeness of it. So if you didn't get into that, it was not going to work. And even my best material would often die in those sort of situations. So,
how long was it until you admitted to people you did stand up?
Well, I mean, I sort of just didn't say when I was, I didn't take anyone with me when I was doing gigs at the beginning. I just didn't know if I was going to be any good or not. And I had, what I had done early on was, I think I was in London and I was doing a gig somewhere, and it was near friends of mine who lived in London as well. So I said, I'll come along. against my better judgment. I thought I was obviously in a sort of upbeat mood, and I thought, yeah, come along, and I'm doing this gig, and I died. And they'd never seen me do comedy, so they just saw me die. So the only thing they'd seen was this. And you know how it can be when you die. It's just that you can't possibly see how, if you're not a comedian as well, how that could have been funny in any world.
Yeah.
That, like, no matter what that person says, or the crowd was, you know, not my demographic, you know, etc. They're just going to go, that is, you are absolute shit. Yeah. And it just looks like that. I know that. So I knew that they would never understand. They would never believe I was good. And that was sort of, I mean, unfortunately, I didn't do it for a while. Then I kept it all a bit secret until I sort of knew I could do it a bit more. It becomes quite ritualistic, I thought, when I did stand-up. I don't do it anymore, but I mean, hats off. I do know people people I started out with are still doing it, and it's great. I sort of decided I wasn't going to do it after a while and didn't miss it. But I wasn't, I don't think...
Hang on, can I ask you this? I'm desperate to know this. I read you did an interview about flowers, and you said you went back to stand-up recently and then quit again.
I wasn't stand-up, it was some character stuff. So, okay. Which I didn't see as the same sort of thing, actually. You went on as it had a sort of idea of a character, and he was a sort of self-help guru. And so I did it briefly to do as a character, which I quite enjoyed. And yeah, I didn't, but I don't really see that as stand-up, I suppose. At the time when I started out, it was, character comedy was not the thing to do, or it wasn't, it was more like get yourself on stage with your personality and be the voice, your own voice, sort of mute slightly, altered, but you basically put. So I didn't really come back to that, but I did have lots of talismans and rituals, of course, you know, before going on stage to try and make it right. And if you saw that person, that death, that kiss of death,
yeah,
that person who sort of is, yeah, I mean, gosh, just taking me back there to that, those car journeys around England with various comedians.
Oh yeah,
it's just endless sort of thing. And you,
especially
die,
if you've died, yeah, oh, you then have the
all
car
the way
journey
back,
back
from Newcastle to London. In a car where they're just taking the piss out of you. I mean, I didn't have thick enough skin, I don't think, for stand-up, no. You know. I think I just sort of found it all too traumatic.
It is really traumatic.
Can be. It was a good way but I mean, it went well enough, I think, for me to think I've got something, which was, I suppose, what you needed is the initial thing was, you went, oh, it's a way of getting your ideas across, and you're getting a response and realizing that the things you're thinking aren't, you know, are have some merit, I suppose. And so in one way it was quite encouraging initially, but I didn't want to carry on with that lifestyle, I don't think, because it was somewhat lonely at the time, the way I was doing it anyway.
Yeah.
But working with other people and making stuff, you know, that.
Well, listen, I've got good news for you.
Mm.
You've died, but there is a heaven. And it's great. It's filled with all your favourite things. What's your favourite thing?
Films.
Yeah, well, fucking hell, you've come to the right place. My God, you're going to love it here. Everyone's obsessed with films. All they want to know about, they want to know about you. They're excited to see you, but they want to know about your life through film.
Mm.
And the first question they ask you is, what is the first film that you remember seeing, Julian Barrett?
Well, I suppose it's Chitty Chitty Bang Bang is one of the first ones I remember being on TV, and the first idea that it came on again and we'd watch it again. So that was the first sort of film that I sort of started to realise it was a film, and you could watch it and you could watch it again, and it came on every Christmas, and it had comedy and horror, and The Child Catcher was a very sort of powerful image and character in a lot of my early nightmares as a young child. So that was one of the first... films I remember seeing, Chitty Chitty Bang Bang.
Do you have siblings, may I ask?
Yes.
Sister. Are you? What's your age? Are you?
Well, older? I'm the sort of oldest.
Yeah. So did you all watch it together, you and your sister?
Yeah, we would, yeah. And she was 2 years younger than me, Emma, my sister. So we had a similar sort of taste in movies and things. But that was an early one, the Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. I mean, Then I remember the first movie I remember going to see. I'm not sure if it was the first movie I went to see, but I think the first one I remember, the vague memory of going to see. Well, I went to see The Black Hole, Disney's Black Hole.
Oh, wow.
With my mates on my birthday. So I'm not sure. I could probably figure out when that was. It was in the 80s, early 80s, that would have been. Because I know that it came out the same year, or maybe it was 79, same year as Alien, Disney's Black Hole. But obviously I didn't see, but I remember seeing that with my mates all on my birthday, and it had some sort of vibrating seat surround sound vibration idea to it. So it was a bit like trying to get people into the cinemas for that reason. But I don't remember much about the film. The film I remember seeing in the cinema, my mum took me to see Jaws. And she snuck me in somehow because I shouldn't have gone in. And she said, when the head popped out of the boat, on Ben Gardner's boat, you know, I apparently stood up in my seat and started screaming. So she had to pull me down, and everyone was looking around going, why are you being abusing your child like this? So that's my, I mean, I sort of remembered it. I remember that vividly, sort of that moment.
Where was this?
In Leeds, where I grew up in Leeds, yeah. So it was all,
wow.
That was me standing up, screaming in that bit.
These are all three scary, scary openers: Cheeky Cheeky Bang Bang, Jaws, and The Black Hole. As far as I remember about The Black Hole was like a Disney trying to do a Star Wars film, but it ends with the ship going into a black hole and them all sort of slowly disappearing into space and dying.
I can't remember the ending. Is it quite bleak like that? I just remember Ernest Borgnine was in it, and there was some robots.
Sweet robot, and then they all die in a black hole.
Yeah, yeah. Not the Disney ending you expect.
You expect that at the beginning of a Disney film, not at the end.
Yeah, yeah. Or they would go through to a magical land or something behind the black hole. But were they all just stretched?
They're just, and they sort of just float around. Unless I'm remembering it wrong, but I definitely think, because the film called The Black Hole, so I guess they've got to deliver on that.
They're on the edge of a black hole, and I don't really know. I've no idea what the premise of it is. I think I can't remember anything about it. The vibrating seats.
What is the film that scared you the most? You like being scared?
I do, yes. Well, it's very dependent, isn't it, when you watch these things, of course, because that changes a little bit like what you find funny, actually, over the years. I mean, some things stay, but at certain stages of your life, certain things are more frightening. And I mean, early on, we got an old, we got a VHS player, and we got videos from the video shop, secret videos, pirate videos. Somehow we managed to get hold of a copy of Alien. So I must have seen that very young, and that was for a long, long time the most frightening film I'd ever seen. And I dreamt of the xenomorph a lot in my nightmares. It featured in many a nightmare, and it was chasing me around. Yeah, the xenomorph pretty much was my nightmare monster for many years. But I loved it, but arguably I was a bit too young to see it. But I don't know, my mum just sort of, she was quite up for me seeing quite a lot of weird stuff early on. I mean, I thank her for that, really, because I still love that film. I still watch it now. There's nothing in it that I have a problem with at all. I mean, there's no, like, where if I watch Jaws now, I'm popped out of it by the shark, unfortunately. I would say that there might be a case, I don't really like the retroactive CGI stuff that you do. But I do think with Jaws, for an audience to watch now, I mean, my kids just laugh when that shark comes on and starts folding.
Yeah.
When it's eating Quint and it's sort of folding and creasing. But if they just did something there, smoothed it, or did something slightly with the shark, then the film would stand up. I mean, it's just let Spielberg know, you know, when you see him, just tell him, he knows.
Yeah, yeah. Listen, I'll text him.
I'm just saying that with Alien, there's absolutely nothing in it I can find any fault with. I don't know, you know, it just seems to hold up anyway. I mean, I was absolutely staggered by that film, and still am, really. So I would say that. But then later on, as you get older, it's more existential, the fears you have, of course. So I would say perhaps more frightening than that would be The Vanishing. I don't know if you know that Dutch film.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's just so horrifying, scary, and bleak, and existential, but brilliantly. It's really scary in a totally different way, I suppose. But of course, as a young kid, I wouldn't be interested in watching that. But
I saw that. I think I was like 12.
Oh yeah,
I'm always amazed.
Was it on your birthday?
Yeah, it was my birthday. I stood up on a chair.
We're going to take you to The Vanishing. Come on, Brad.
But it's, I've remembered all of it. Do you know what I mean? I haven't seen it since.
Yeah,
I can tell you everything
film. I do not want to see it again, but that's no detriment to the film. You know, there's certain films I would never want to see again. That's one of them, I think. I just wouldn't want to. Funny Games as well. It's like they're incredible films, but they're a little bit, they're bone cold. They're sort of like psychologically chilling and incredibly well constructed. And you see them once and you go, thanks a lot. And thanks for that. And I don't want to see that again, but that's amazing. I suppose if I was going to make a horror and it was, I might look at it again maybe and think, how did that sort of sense of, you know, maybe.
Yeah. Would you like to make a horror?
I'd love to make a horror. Yes, yes. I'd love to. So
why don't you?
I will. Thank you. Yes,
thank you.
Okay. I'm gonna. No, I should and I will. And I have a, I don't know. I suppose I've got a few ideas and I'm always tinkering with them. And so I would love to do a horror. I'd love to do that. I find it harder on TV to find something, because it's usually a one-hit sort of thing where you can build the sense of dread and tension and release it all. And so it's hard in a TV sort of environment to create the same sort of thing. But, I mean, there's been some pretty good examples of it. But I think I prefer the either one-shot sort of attempt to try and... For horror.
Yeah.
I do like that somehow. So I would say that The Vanishing is a pretty horrifying film in that way. Yeah, but.
Great answer.
Julian Barrett, what's the film that made you cry the most? And are you a crier?
Yes, I mean, I do cry at certain films pretty reliably.
Yeah.
So I would say I cry at One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest every time I see it, pretty much.
Great film.
I suppose It's a Wonderful Life I cry at as well, and I often cry at Casablanca. Mm-hmm. These little things. What else do I cry at? But I would say reliably, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, you know. Yes.
Do you cry in real life, or are you... Do you keep that locked up?
I have done. I mean, I'm from the north of England where it was sort of frowned upon as a thing to do. And so I had to work my way through that with therapy and, self-help books. So now I'm slightly more in touch with that and able to cry slightly more. But it was always a thing you didn't really do. You sort of kept it in and got on with things and had a breakdown later on in life, I think is what they were hoping, so they didn't have to deal with it when you were. So we just kicked that problem down the road and dealt with it all in my 40s and beyond. So hopefully now I'm a bit more in touch with that. So I do cry a bit more in life. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I do. But I can get sad. I can get sad at films, you know, quite a lot, but tears, not usually, perhaps. I'll tell you what I did cry at recently. It was Coco.
Oh my days!
Yeah,
yeah,
and that really was made me cry at the end of that. So they did that really as well constructed to create.
I've talked about this on the podcast before, but it was a while ago, so I can say it again. Genuinely changed how I feel about death, Coco. It did help me.
Yeah,
it actually made me go, okay, as long as you remembered.
It's a brilliant idea, and so incredibly well put together, and the metaphor is so amazing and poetic, and it's all about it's about playing guitar as well, so it spoke to me on this sort of, I play guitar constantly, so I'm like, I just kind of loved it in that respect, you know, as well. So, and the music was phenomenal, and I mean, I'm not a sort of Pixar maniac as much as perhaps some folks are. I mean, I understand they're incredibly well constructed, but I have a sort of, but I really did like Coco a lot, actually. I really did. I mean, I love all the Toy Story films as well, but I find I have a problem, slight problem with the way they look somehow. I don't know, a very basic sort of crass level, and it's not a very deep observation, but I just don't get on with the way they look.
I respect that.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Hacks is back for season 3, and so is the official Hacks podcast. In each episode, Hacks creators Lucia Aniello, Paul W. Downs, and Jen Stadtsky speak with cast and crew members to unpack the Emmy-winning comedy series. you'll hear Hannah Einbinder and Jean Smart speak to their on-screen dynamic, along with Hacks writer and actor Pat Regan, on how their improv experience helped them when shooting scenes and what it was like writing scripts for specific actors.
You'll also hear from crew members like the costume designers on what it was like creating the world that Deborah and Ava inhabit. Hear stories from the show's writer's room, on-set antics, and more. Watch Hacks streaming exclusively on Max, and listen to the official Hacks podcast on Max or wherever you get your podcasts.
Yeah.
What's the film that people don't really like? It's not critically acclaimed, but you are just like, you're all fucking idiots. I love this film.
It's hard because I don't really have guilty pleasures. I sort of put that away a while ago because I realized that I could like whatever I wanted. And I think because I used to know a quite snobby chap who was very much about art films and all these sort of high-end movies. And he didn't have time for any of the popcorn films, as he called them. And the bubblegum films, it was all like, no, it's not really meaning. It's just not worth it watching this stuff. And I was really, this was at university. So I remember hanging out with this guy a lot and going along with it, going, yeah, you're right. We need to see all this stuff, all these strange films. So we did. I saw a lot of those films and saw some great stuff. But I also thought, I love just sort of basic, simple, popular films as well. And then I sort of came to terms with that, I suppose, early on. So I don't really have a guilty pleasure, but... I mean, I used to sort of watch I like survival films, so
yeah,
I like those a lot. And I like The Edge a lot. And I did remember, do you know The Edge? Anthony Hopkins.
Yeah, is that the one David Mamet wrote it?
Yeah. I don't know. So anyway, that's not really supposed to be bad, but some people think it is, and I absolutely love it. But so I would get a lot of people sort of going on at me because I've always wanted to watch The Edge on tour buses and things like that when everyone was going... let's put a movie on, and if we were on tour with the Bush and stuff, and I would, let's go, can we watch The Edge? And they're going, oh, again? Apparently, I'd shown them it all before early on in the tour, but I was probably drunk. But I would watch that quite often. It's a little, I find it very comforting. But a film I actually did like, which was, I can see is absolute rubbish in a way, was Wolf with Jack Nicholson.
I genuinely got the poster for Wolf in my living room.
I mean, I just know that it's sort of badly, it's badly rubbish. Cast. It's like Jack Nicholson is just not, you don't want to see him leaping about. He looks a bit chunky. He hasn't sort of worked out and he's leaping around and he's trying to be a wolf and it's a bit embarrassing. But something about it I really like. I like the idea of it all, I think, at the beginning. And I don't know, and I like James Spader pretending to be a wolf. And they have this battle scene where it's like James Spader and Anthony Hopkins flying each other on wires, and it's just so misguided.
It's really bad. It's a good idea. It's a good idea.
Yes, it is. The type of idea of the sort of work and the sort of macho work sort of... I don't know. I don't know why. I just sort of liked it, and I liked its sort of over-the-topness. And I know it was... I could see why it didn't work in lots of ways, but I would watch that film if it came on, even though I know it's sort of a misguided sort of...
it's really Wolf. Bad.
I mean, it's bad, yeah.
It does look like he's on like a trampette.
Yes, he keeps doing those leaps.
They put like a log in front of him and he does a little jump.
Yes. Absolutely, yeah, that's exactly how he sort of leaps.
What's the film that means the most to you? Not necessarily the film itself is any good, but because the experience you had around seeing the film will always make it special to you.
I mean, it's not necessarily a good film, but the first film that I got in to see with my mates was a double A, it was called, which was a sort of weird certificate. But I wasn't old enough. I think you had to be, well, it's a bit like PG maybe, but I can't remember exactly what a double A was. But I wasn't old enough, and I had to get, it was Every Which Way But Loose with Clint Eastwood. And I was a big Clint Eastwood fan even then. But so I snuck in with my mate Christopher Wright, who had a bit of a moustache. So he just, the beginnings of a moustache, I sort of went behind him and we sort of snuck into this double A feature. So it's a very exciting time in my life. We went to the Cottage Road in Leeds, which is interesting, where we had a showing of Mindhorn there. And I remember, so it was like a weird sort of thing where I remember sneaking into that cinema underage to see Every Which Way But Loose. And with my mate Christopher Wright and his sort of just burgeoning moustache, and got in there to see that. So it was a very exciting time sneaking into a movie when you're not old enough.
Did Christopher Wright come to the screening of Mindhorn?
No, that's an interesting. I'd like to. he's changed. I don't know where he is anymore. So I lost touch with him, and you know.
Could I just point out that we've been recording this podcast for a while. The lighting on Julian's Zoom has changed from like an indie film to a film noir, and it looks fucking cool now. But he's just lit by one single source, he's in Taxi Driver or something.
The Godfather, yeah.
Looking really good.
Thank you.
I don't know if this was deliberate, but it's very cool.
It is changing, isn't it? I can see now. Yeah, it's because there's no light on in here, so it's just actually the sun setting.
Beautiful, very moody. You're a visual man. What's the film that you most relate to?
I'm not really answering this in a very good way, I suppose. I should have answered it in a more serious way, but I don't know. I remember being very excited when a film called Crossroads came out with Ralph Macchio playing a guitarist. Again, another guitar film, because mm-hmm. as a kid, it was my main thing was playing guitar as I got a bit older. And it came out right at my sort of crucial sort of age of, I think it was about, I don't know, I was in my teens and I was obsessed with playing guitar. And this film came out where Ralph Macchio played a guitarist who sold his soul to the devil. And it's called Crossroads. And it really spoke to me, it's a terrible film, I'm sure. But Steve Vai was the devil's guitarist. And I had a thing about Steve Vai at the time. No one will know who he is, but a sort of fusion jazz, crazy rock guitarist who was pretty incredible. And so it was just everything. It ticked all my boxes as a young 16-year-old sort of shredder. And so that was my dream sort of film at that time, you know. But yeah.
Feel free to spoil it. Because at first I thought you meant the Britney Spears movie Crossroads, and I was really excited that that was the film you guys related to. But what is...
Crossroads, it's a guy, he's a classic...
What happens when he sells his soul? What happens at the end?
I can't actually remember it that well. There's a lot of problems remembering these films, but I do remember the point with... He was a classically trained guitar player who wanted to play the blues. So he met up with some sort of dude at a crossroads and some old magical guy who told him he could play the blues. But it was like a lost sort of blues song that he had to learn. I can't remember what happened, actually. I remember there was quite a lot of guitar playing in it, and it was...
It was just really relatable.
Yeah, on a very superficial way, yeah. I mean, that was just the fact that I played guitar and I was about his age. So I was not working on any sort of deep levels, no. I'm sure there are more films that I relate to in a psychological way, perhaps.
No, I love that. I love that. No, that's deep. You also played karate when you were little, didn't you?
I did judo, yeah. So, but then I stopped judo because it clashed with the $6 Million Man on TV, so I stopped going to judo. Because it clashed.
Amazing.
It was the same time. I was like, there's just no way I'm missing that.
Yeah. I love your priorities. That's great.
Yeah. Yeah.
Here we go. Julian Barrett, what's the sexiest film you've ever seen? Oh, no. I think you've frozen. Have you frozen?
Wait. You froze. You completely froze. I didn't hear any of it.
Oh.
Sorry.
Jenny Agutter.
Start again. Jenny Agutter, huge.
Jenny Agutter, Railway Children was the first. Her sort of... She was the one for me in my youth, mm-hmm. Jenny, and from Railway Children through Walkabout through American Werewolf, you know. So yeah. that was for me the she was the one, yeah. Still and Call the Midwife. She's still got it.
Call the Midwife. She's still got it. There's a subcategory to this question, Julian, and the subcategory is troubling boners. Worrying Wydons, a film you found arousing, you thought maybe you shouldn't have.
There's nothing troubling about a boner. I mean, I suppose it could be troubling. I don't know. I would say I found Channing Tatum quite attractive. I like his eyes. And I did find him quite attractive in something. But it's not troubling, really. But maybe a younger version of me perhaps would have been troubled by that. But now.
I like your absolute lack of shame in your boners. I think that's really healthy.
Yeah.
You can't cry, but you'll get a boner anyway. It doesn't matter.
You can't cry.
I love that.
I'm not ashamed. No, I'm not embarrassed. But I would. I wouldn't be if. No, I mean, early on, of course, you're incredibly embarrassed. I mean, so I suppose when American Werewolf was on TV as a kid and the scene with Jenny was, that would be mortifying. I remember my grandma was around for Christmas that came on. So I totally forgot the fact that someone goes down on her in the middle of the film. They both have a sort of oral scene. So I could not, that was terrifying and mortifying at the time, obviously. And same with Ghostbusters. I found that very erotic, actually, as a young guy, when Sigourney Weaver's possessed by, is it Zool or? But that's not trouble. That's just, you know, pretty fair that's enough. I'm pretty meat and potatoes in a way. I haven't got any, you know, this is all pretty standard stuff. There's nothing off the charts.
Listen, that's the reason I ask is sort of just a check. And it's good to hear. You've passed, you're absolutely fine. It's just a little check I like to do with the guests. What is objectively the greatest film of all time? Not your favourite, the greatest.
Oh.
The pinnacle of cinema.
I mean, yes, Casablanca, and yes, all those sort of films.
Yes, Casablanca, great answer.
It's one of those things, I don't know what to say. It just changes every day for me in terms of what I think is great. But
today, the day you died, which
today,
one?
Oh, the day I died. I'd probably say, you know, Ghost with Patrick Swayze.
Love it.
Probably about as good as it gets. No, I mean, I'm serious. It's like,
a really
I think
good
it's
film.
It's actually better than Hamlet.
Oh, yes.
Because I know apparently the guy who wrote it said he was seeing Hamlet. He went to see Hamlet and thought,
really?
I wonder what the ghost's perspective of this is. And then you think, and that's sort of what it is. But if you thought about, if Shakespeare was writing something, if he was around now, that would be how he would do the story, I think.
Great. It's so much better than Hamlet. I'd much rather watch Ghost. I'd watch Ghost twice than watch Hamlet.
And then it's got incredible Whoopi Goldberg moments. So the comedy's good. The scary stuff's good. It's got the romance. It's got a love story. It's got brilliant ideas. Some early sort of CGI. Still works.
Weird pottery sex that's always a bit troubling.
Swayze. Pretty good... That was a troubling moment. But no, it wasn't troubling. I mean, it was...
For them, maybe. It depends.
Erotic.
What happened with all the clay?
Yeah.
Excellent answer. You can have that.
Ghost. I'm a ghost. It's happening.
What is the film you could or have watched the most over and over again?
That is probably Die Hard, I would have said.
Lovely film.
Again, that could be literally the best film I've ever made, I suppose, on any other day from today. Would be. But I would say Die Hard is the one that maybe goes on the most in our house now and over the years as well. Through the years, has been a staple of every Christmas, and then it was almost like having children for me. It was like it was all about basically when is it too soon to watch Die Hard or when is it right? That's what I was thinking from the moment they were born. Mm-hmm. It's like, wow, they're so beautiful. And also, how long is it before we can watch Die Hard? When is the age? So it's very exciting to finally...
What was the age?
We were two. They were probably too young, but they were about 10.
Okay.
So, they did love it. And I didn't want to show them it. I did. There was a few other things we'd watched and they'd been getting into something. I think it was Brooklyn Nine-Nine. And the guy in it, the main chap... anyway, he was obsessed. That's it. Yeah, he's obsessed in the film. He's obsessed with Die Hard in the TV show. So they kept asking about it, and so then we said, right. I said, right. Let's do this. And it worked. It worked for them, and it always works every time. It's just incredible. I do watch that a lot, and Predator, strangely, a lot as well. I never seem to. I have kind of watched those all the time with people, usually and always, but mostly with people actually. Get those out, they always work. But Die Hard, of course, you know, everyone understands it's pretty much perfect, isn't it, the construction of it, everything about it.
Never really been topped, has it?
I suppose it's the sort of I've seen a lot of other good thrillers, but it's, what is it, what would you say it is, Brett?
I'll tell you what it is. Well, I think it is. I think, A, it's very simple, and it's a simple idea, and the idea is great.
Yeah.
And you very quickly care about the characters. And when he does his toes on the carpet, you go, oh, I love this character, I'm in.
Yeah.
Simple setup. He's got to get his wife back. Everything's told very economically. But I also think the main thing that hasn't been replicated is that he gets a cut on his foot. Like, that's the lowest moment in the film is he's got glass in his foot. And it's so much more relatable than a city exploding and planets falling out of the sky. It's like, you've cut your foot before. It's horrible. And that's he's much more vulnerable. It's
So you relate to him in that respect, I suppose. And you relate to his pain and you relate to his emotional pain because they're all things, you know, he's regretting how he's behaved with his wife.
It's quite small. All of
so those things,
small.
Yeah.
The skyscraper's big, but he's small. His struggles are smallish comparatively to bigger films.
Yeah, yeah, of course. That's sort of one of the, and I suppose, I mean, maybe that was the first time, or it came off the back of a lot of gung-ho 80s sort of heroes, didn't it? So I suppose suddenly he was relatable in a way that they weren't, and that's why it's hard to reproduce it, because it came at a certain
time. And he's not super fit, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
He's kind of average fit, and he's funny.
Yeah.
And he's a bit of a dick, but he's all right, really.
And of course, a great villain as well.
Great villain, come on, that's the real key.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, he's one of the best. So that's it. A great villain as well. Yeah,
that's that problem solved.
I forgot to say about Blair Witch. Oh damn!
Go on.
No, just that it was obviously it sort of starts off like, you know, you start off being scared by various things in the films, and then but that was one particular one. I remember going to the cinema to see that and being really, really scared witless by Blair Witch. And a lot of people don't find it scary. A lot of people find it annoying for some reason. I don't know why, but it's sort of, it's a bit more, I find that quite difficult to understand. I mean, I understand that now people go, oh, found footage and it's a bit bored with it. But at the time, it was phenomenal. Phenomenal. I think. And the idea that a lot of those early horror novels were sort of almost found footage, like Dracula was a little bit like a found footage thing, and some Edgar Allan Poe stuff is done in letters. So it's like kind of one of those things where it's in the form of a letter, it feels real. So the Blair Witch was a bit like a new kind of way of doing horror in that way, which is so, so real, which is often, anyway. So I just remember being absolutely, that was so scary. And then, but then I remember going on holiday. Later, we were in the countryside, me and my mates, and we decided to watch Blair Witch on a laptop in a graveyard to see if that was what that was like. Not frightening, strangely. Yeah, so that's a disappointing story. So I don't know really why I went back to that one. But it's more that it was because the surroundings were scary and we were very sort of excited to put it on. And we put it on, and then when you're watching a movie in a graveyard on a laptop and you can see the sort of the apple... So you have to dim the Apple buttons and stuff. You're suddenly aware that it's a technology, and I don't know what it was. It just didn't work really. So it made me realize, I think, the power of just being in a dark cinema with lots of people, which I do still like to do. Unfortunately, not able to at the moment. But it would be good to get back to that.
That's all I'm after.
It's just a little something for the Patreons. pop that.
I'm putting that in the main. The mains are getting that.
You said, that's not a good enough story for the patrons. Right, okay. Let's carry on.
I don't want to deprive the mains of it, is what I'm saying. We don't like to be too negative on this show, but what's the worst film you've ever seen?
Well, I know. I mean, it's easy to make a bad film, I think, and it obviously is as hard to make a bad film as a good one and all that. And I understand, and I feel sort of for people who do, and I'm sure... And I've done stuff that it was hard to do and it was not good. But I mean, I did see a film which I think is pretty much probably one of the worst films. I did get through it because it became increasingly just mesmeric. And that was London Fields. I don't know if you've seen that, but.
Oh, I've read all about it, but I've never watched it. I've read the process of making that.
I think it was a fraught process. It was fraught, and I think lots of things went wrong. And it was Johnny Depp and Amber Heard were at loggerheads, and I don't know. And but it's just awful in the most. It's incredible, but it's a real it's a real swing and a miss. They've really gone for it, I suppose, is what it, why you sort of heart goes out to them a little bit in that respect, you know, because they're just going for it. And it's Cockney. It's about darts. It's an adaptation of a Martin Amis book, which, I mean, they don't transfer well to screen, it seems. It's darts. It's, and the main guy is Billy Bob Thornton's the main dude.
Wow.
And he's, you know, incredible. But he's not bad in it, but it's like a documentary in which he's in a film, but he's trying to sort of get out of, or he doesn't want to be in the film. But it's like, so you're watching him, he's brilliant, even though, I don't know, within it, but it's like there's things going on around him, and it's almost like he's trying to say, get help. This is help me get out of here. Which is interesting. I mean,
I had no idea it was about darts.
It's just the most unbelievable. It's unbelievable to watch. It's really, really, it's fun to watch, I would say. I mean, I would say that it was pretty, pretty funny to watch. Pretty much one of the worst I think I've seen. Yeah.
Wow.
That was quite recent. I mean, I did enjoy, in terms of bad films, I liked, I enjoyed the badness and the wrongness of Jupiter Ascending. I thought that was quite sort of funny.
Oh, yeah.
Although, I don't know, maybe you like that, but I did think that was quite strange. Channing Tatum as a sort of weird roller skating werewolf character and Sean Bean controlling bees. I don't know. I think with that, it seemed like that film, I'd heard that they, because it's the Wachowski siblings who made it. And I think that what happened on, because you wonder how those people ended up doing that film, that such good sort of high-end people, it was Mila Kunis and Channing Tatum and all these big actors. But I think because a lot of people apparently turned down The Matrix first off. And so when another script came from those guys, it was like, fuck, I'm in. Get me on board with this. But it was a 300, 400-page script, and it was like, doesn't matter. Although
I'm not going to read it. It'll be fine.
Yeah, I think it was just one of those.
What do I play? You play a fox, dog, pig. Okay.
Yeah, but that's pretty bad. And then an earlier one of those was an early bad, when I just was like astounded by how bad it was The Island of Dr. Moreau with Val Kilmer. Which is what it is, incredibly watchable, knowing the story behind it now and the incredible story of the director who was sacked and then snuck back onto the set dressed as one of the creatures. I mean, it's just incredible.
He's amazing. Have you seen that documentary about it?
Yeah.
It's amazing.
It's brilliant. I mean, they should remake it from his perspective, sneaking back on.
Yeah.
Like, do a sort of a meta jiu-jitsu film where it's from his perspective, sneaking back onto the film, you know.
That's a great idea.
Do that, you know, it's a little idea. Just so
you can do that after your horror film, but won't you make in your horror film next?
Yeah.
And then maybe that is a horror film.
Yeah, you could do a lot of those. There's I do think you could do one with quite a good film, watching Back to the Future the other day. I was thinking you could do a film of a modern sort of take on it. Eric Stoltz going back in time to sort of recast himself in the film. Could that work?
Yeah. I think about that so much.
About Eric Stoltz? Almost every day?
I'd say every day.
Almost every night about it. Before you drop off?
Before I drop off, I think, how did he ever get past that?
I know.
How did you get past that?
I know.
He dropped months of it. He's told all his friends. He's told his family.
I know.
And look, he's a really good actor. I say this with massive respect to him. I think he's great. But I'm also like, how did you ever get past that?
Yeah.
And then the film goes on to become, you know, all-time great, blah, blah, blah.
I know, because I've done things before where I've thought, I'm not telling people if it's exciting or something. I'm not telling my kids because they'll... And if it's something good. And then I'm not going to do it because I know what's going to happen. I'm going to get cut, as you often do in these things, if they're big films, and you're doing a little turn. And then you've told your kids, they'll have told their mates. And then what happens, it comes out and then... I'm not in it. And their mates will go, you said that your dad was in this film. He's not in it. So what's that about? And they'd be bullied. They'd develop problems later in life. So But that is difficult. Stoltz getting over that. That's got to be.
And the fact that everyone knows, it isn't like a secret. It wasn't like, there was. It's like, here's a couple of clips of Eric Stoltz not doing it right.
Forever.
Oh man.
I think he should do like TED Talks on resilience, because I think that's the strongest man I've ever heard of. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I don't know what's stopped, but yeah, I don't know what he's up to these days, you know. But building a time machine. Nothing's right.
Julian Barrett, you're in comedy, you're a very funny man. What's the film that made you laugh the most?
When I sort of went to university, the film that we watched constantly was With Neil and I. So it became a kind of a bit of a touchstone for me and a lot of my friends in that era where I was at university in the 90s. And so we all watched it as a sort of matter of, it was like a thing we did. We watched it and drank along with it, and it was a cult favorite of ours. And we watched it all the time, and we started quoting it and saying and we'd screen it, and everyone knew the dialogue, and so it became sort of inextricably linked with my whole time at university, and had such fun watching. It gave us such fun, and out and about, out in pubs, just doing it and quoting the lines. And I mean, we were hideous, I'm sure, but we were absolutely in love with that film. And I suppose it just, I don't know, it just gave me such joy. And I think I laughed. Mm. I coincided with various, you know, just being out and about and getting drunk a lot. So it just became a sort of our film. I sort of think that's that gave me the most laughter at, probably, you know.
Love it. Love that.
Yeah, I mean, it's an astounding film. I mean, I remember that, you know, I remember reading Bruce Robinson saying, because he said that Bill Nye nearly played the With Neil part, gave a good account of himself in the casting, but didn't get it. So, interesting, not that that's an Eric Stoltz. I mean, he didn't record half of it and then get cut. But, you know, just the way it could have gone. But,
it's such a, like, unique film. There's nothing really like With Neil and I, and it's quite hard.
Yes.
To pitch, if you say, what's it? What is it? What's With Neil and I?
I know, and it's very personal, I think, to Bruce Robinson, isn't it? And I think he's annoyed because he didn't make anything out of it, money-wise, and it's still sort of, I think it just sort of needles them every time people talk. But in the end, it's like, it's just an incredible testament to his genius. Incredible. That performance as well. I mean, both of them are great in it, but...
Yeah.
I mean, I think I relate a lot to double act films. I love double acts. I haven't been in one, I suppose, but I'm very drawn to any film with a double act. I'm straight in there usually, you know. Those defiant ones I always love, you know, with Tony Curtis, and that one where they're chained together. And I mean, I love that. Sideways, I love.
I'm
big into those sort of, I don't know, I love double act films.
That's really interesting. Did you love double acts before you were a double act?
I did, actually. Yeah. So it's almost like I was sort of waiting to meet that sort of, you know. I've done a lot of double, even when I played guitar there, I was in a sort of double act with another guitarist. So, and then I got into, through comedy, I always found I like the dynamic of two characters who are at odds with each other in some way, but still. Mm. So I don't know. I'm always drawn to that sort of relationship, which I, for some reason.
Interesting. Julian Barrett, you've been an absolute fucking joy. I've loved this. I'm very, very grateful you did it. However, when you were playing the S. Gibson at the Bullingate, was it? Bullingate. But you were in the massive warehouse at the back of the Bullingate, just rehearsing. No one there, just you. You've never been happier, sadly, for all the people that know and love you. Your happiest was you alone in an empty warehouse playing guitar. And you played solo, obviously, because there's no one else there. And you played it so fast, it was the fastest you'd ever played this solo, that your heart rate increased. You were fucking buzzing. You were buzzing like you just committed a crime. You were buzzing. Your heart rate was going up. And then suddenly your heart exploded right at the peak, just at the peak of the song as well. If only people had been watching, it was quite something. Anyway, I'm wandering past the Bullingate. You know what I'm like, always in that area. And I'm thinking, where's Julian? Is he on tonight? Is he going to be in the warehouse? I look in the warehouse. Oh, boy, it's an absolute mess. It's a state. You have exploded everywhere, right? So I've got a coffin with me. It's the size of you.
I'm putting bits of you in this coffin, but you're also, you've got it meshed in some of the wood and the brick. Having to put lots of bits of you in this coffin. Ends up, there's more of you than I thought there would be. The coffin is absolutely rammed. It's jam-packed. There's very little room in it. There is only enough room for me to slip one DVD into the side with you, for you to take to the other side. And on the other side, it's movie night every night. One night, it's your movie night. What film are you taking to show everyone in heaven when it's your movie night, Julian Barrett?
It's gonna be Predator.
I love it.
It's gonna be Predator.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know if anyone's brought that before. If they have, I could always say something else. But
I can't remember. Let's say Predator. That's a great answer. Yes,
you know, I just think that's gonna work. That's gonna work on an audience, whether they're doing or not.
Yeah, I think you're going to be very popular in heaven. Julian Barrett, you've passed, and you get to, like Patrick Swayze at the end of Go to the Other Side. Is there anything you'd like to tell people to look out for or listen to in the coming weeks of yours?
Of mine?
Yeah.
So I have done a show called Bloods, and that's coming out at some point. I don't know. That's what I've done over lockdown.
Julian Barrett, God bless you. Thank you for doing this. Have a wonderful day, and I will see you soon. Good day.
Good night.
That was episode 131. Head over to the Patreon at patreon.com/Brett Goldstein for the extra 20 minutes of chat, a big secret and a video with Julian. See his light get well moody. You can see it all there. Head over to Apple Podcasts and give us a 5-star rating and write about the film that means the most to you and why. It is lovely to read. I do actually read them. I really like it, and it also helps numbers, and I really appreciate it. Thank you very much. So thank you to Julian for giving me all that time. Thank you to Moon for making this happen. Thanks to Scroobius Pip and the Distraction Pieces Network. Thanks to Buddy Peace for producing it and doing an amazing job this week. As always, thanks to Acast for hosting it. Thanks to Adam Richardson for the graphics and Lisa Lyland for the photography. Next week, I will be finally doing the extra late, super special, extra amazing end of year special with Nish Kumar, where we will try and work out exactly which films count as 2020 and what we thought of them and all that stuff. I think this is early because I checked the last time we did the end of year last time in February. So you're getting it. I mean, we're getting ahead of ourselves, if anything. It's going to be great. You'll love it. So I hope everyone's well, and I hope you're all having a nice time. So that is it for now. In the meantime, have a lovely week, and please, now more than ever, be excellent to each other.
The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is your space to explore mental health, personal development, and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia, and I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday. Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.
Welcome to season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. I've got some big news to share with you in our season premiere featuring the one and only Kris Jenner.
Oh my gosh, congratulations. That is very, very exciting.
And that's just the beginning. We'll also be joined by podcast host Jay Shetty, Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, and many more. So come on in, take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.